I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In our conversation today, activist soldiers, should troops be able to speak out against military policy? But first, that's the sound of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis marching in the southern Iraqi city of Najaf today, marking the fourth anniversary of the fall of Baghdad with a protest calling for American withdrawal. The rally was organized by radical Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr and billed as a call for liberation. The cities of Baghdad and Najaf banned vehicle traffic for the day to prevent violence on this anniversary, and Iraq was relatively quiet, but 10 U.S. soldiers were killed over the weekend in areas outside of the capital. Joining us from Baghdad, LA Times correspondent Ned Parker. And Ned, set the scene for us now. Is all quiet? Have the protests stopped?
The protest was very disciplined, orderly, lasted 3 hours, and ended early in the afternoon.
Couple questions. First of all, has anyone seen Muqtada al-Sadr? He hasn't been seen in public for months.
Right. He has not been seen since before the Baghdad security plan was started. Definitely some of his foot soldiers and some of those quote-unquote splinter groups from his movement are in Iran right now. Whether Sadr is or isn't is a big question, because he represents a nationalist strain inside Iraqi politics. He's one of the very few Iraqi figures who stayed in the country throughout Saddam's regime and is now in a position of power. All the other major politicians were in exile. So for him to actually be in Iran in many ways would be an awful political move for him and could hurt his long-term credibility.
Well, in calling for today's rally, Muqtada al-Sadr over the weekend called the U.S. Iraq's arch enemy. Was he calling for a fight or for political action?
The leaders of his political bloc in parliament insist that they are no longer in the stage of armed revolt, which the Sadr movement was in 2004, but now they're waging a peaceful resistance. But there's a lot of tension in his movement. There are those under his command who want to fight, but there are those who don't, and Sadr is riding the wave.
Well, a U.S. military spokesman said the rally today marked progress in Iraq, showing that Iraqis have gained the right to assemble and free speech. But we understand that there were also reports of Iraqi police and soldiers dancing with the protesters. Was there military presence in Najaf, do you know? And what is the sense of the military statement interpreting the rally?
I wouldn't be surprised that police or even Iraqi army members would join with the protesters in demanding that the Americans leave. Sadr is a nationalist figure, and Iraqis are very resentful, well, not all of them, but certainly many, of what they see as an ongoing occupation. So it's natural that Sadr would be able to tap into that. Obviously, the U.S. military will want to highlight a huge peaceful rally as a positive development. And it is impressive that people can gather and express their will nonviolently, but I think it's a danger to take too much of it.
Well, we just want to ask about one last thing before we let you go. You had a report in the Sunday LA Times on how U.S.-run detention camps in Iraq have become breeding grounds for terrorists. You quote an official saying it looks like a terrorist academy in these detention camps and that the Americans have no solution to this problem. Just briefly, you know, how big a problem is this?
Well, the Americans think it is a problem. They themselves said to us that they're working to combat extremist groups inside the prison who are trying to recruit other prisoners and who are running Sharia courts, Islamic courts, and that it's an ongoing struggle. It's an issue. It's an issue even in America. When people go into prison, some people come out as hardened criminals if they were borderline before. In other wars, the Algeria War that the French fought in the 50s and 60s, the saying was that the French detention centers were a university for insurgents, and that's very much the case in Iraq with the detention centers.
LA Times correspondent Ned Parker speaking to us from Baghdad. Ned, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, Navy Lieutenant Jason Nichols, an information technology specialist stationed in Baghdad, is asking his fellow troops to sign an online petition called An Appeal for Courage. It reads in part, "I respectfully urge my political leaders in Congress to fully support our mission in Iraq and halt any calls for retreat. The war in Iraq is a necessary and just effort to bring freedom to the Middle East and protect America from further attack." Well, that appeal is in response to another one called an appeal for redress from the war in Iraq. More than 1,800 members of the armed forces have signed that online appeal, and it calls for U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. Our next guest says, either way, this new soldiers' lobby signals a dangerous movement. Andrew Basevich is a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. He served in Vietnam. He's now a professor of international relations at Boston University. His essay about this appeal for redress appears in the May issue of the Atlantic Monthly, and he joins us now with more. Welcome, as always, Professor.
Thank you.
You say this is a new soldiers' lobby, and our first thought was, is it really? You know, in the late 60s, thousands of soldiers signed a New York Times ad against the war. They protested at peace marches, as they're doing today. So what is different?
Well, I think there have been, and Vietnam is a good example in the past, of soldiers who have in one way or another protested. But both the appeal for redress and this new appeal for courage strike me as different, and I think very problematic. They are, as you said in your introduction, soldiers' lobbies. They are indicative of an assertion on the part of soldiers that they ought to have a voice in deciding policy. And that assertion really is at odds with the principle of civilian control, which is really one of the foundational principles of U.S. military policy. Huh. So my view of anything that promotes the politicization of the military is a bad thing. And I believe that one should endorse that principle regardless of where one happens to stand on the Iraq war.
Well, we read the appeal for courage. Let's read the appeal for redress. It was drafted by an Iraq war veteran and a Navy seaman. They both said, by the way, they took inspiration from the 1975 book Soldiers in Revolt, GI Resistance During the Vietnam War. It reads in part, "As a patriotic American proud to serve the nation in uniform, I respectfully urge my political leaders in Congress to support the prompt withdrawal of all American military forces and bases from Iraq. Staying in Iraq will not work and is not worth the price. It is time for U.S. troops to come home." Actually, I just read the whole thing. That is it. That's the whole appeal. Now, you have been with us before. We should say you are a critic of the war in Iraq.
I actually endorse that general sentiment that the war is a mistake, that the war is unwinnable. My problem is the one of principle. The Constitution does not provide for the military as an institution or soldiers as individuals or soldiers as lobbies having that kind of a role to play in establishing policy. It is the business of citizens. It is the business of the Congress. It is the business of the executive branch to decide policy. It's not the business of the military.
Well, let's listen to a little of what Navy Seaman Jonathan Hutto told us last year after he started this Appeal for Redress website.
One has to make a distinction between following an order, which we're all sworn to do, in which this appeal is not jeopardizing in any sense, and then expressing what your own personal reservations are, your own personal views and your own personal misgivings on your own personal time. There is a difference there.
Well, do you think there's a – you obviously don't think there's a difference there.
Well, I think that – I mean, although the creators of the appeal have styled it as, in a sense – I think there's 1,700 signatories now, as 1,800 individual soldiers and sailors who are acting individually and submitting this appeal for redress. In fact, it's a collective petition.
It's a petition, as you say, and we should stress that they have that right to individually. Tell us what a soldier has a right to do.
A soldier has a right to appeal for redress, meaning to write to his or her congressman. To ask for assistance with regard to some personal grievance. In other words, I write my congressman because my pay's all screwed up, or I write my congressman because my sergeant's picking on me and the chain of command has not done anything about it.
Do you have the right to write your sergeant or your congressman, or do you have the right to write your congressman because you don't agree with the war that you're fighting?
You may do that if you don't agree with the war as an individual. Again, the issue here, though, is we're doing this collectively and we're doing it publicly, and regardless of whoever it was Seaman Hutto said, they are doing it as an effort to try to shape congressional opinion to undermine the authority of their commander-in-chief. I would emphasize, I think this war is misguided and needs to be ended, but It's not up to soldiers to decide that.
Well, you point a lot of fingers, too, when you say, end-running Congress. You say that Congress has dropped the ball on its job in examining the war, and the media also has, in a way, inflamed this by sort of giving the impression that soldiers have this right by, for instance, running polls on how soldiers
I do. I find that very reprehensible. I mean, it's the Military Times newspaper company. It's a private firm that basically publishes papers that are targeted towards a military audience, and they've now taken to conducting polls of military members asking whether or not military members approve of President Bush's job performance, whether or not they support the war. I think that that's reckless and reprehensible, again, because it chips away at the principle of civilian control. If we are intent on playing the role of a global leader, if we are intent on maintaining this enormous and costly military establishment, then we need to be all the more attentive to the importance of preserving that principle. I think in a small way, the appeal for redress is not going to, jeopardize the existence of the republic.
Well, in
but
fact,
in
it's a fraction of troops that have signed on.
In a small way, it's a bad sign of the increasing politicization of the American military. And from that point of view, it ought to be of some concern to us as citizens.
We're coming up on a break in a couple of minutes. By the way, if you're listening out there and you want to ask Andrew Bacevich a question about this topic, feel free to email us at letters@here-now.com. By the way, somebody's already written and said, what do you think, then, if he agrees with you that troops should not become involved in speaking out, taking sides, being partisan? He said, but on the other hand, should presidents be able to use troops for political backdrops?
I think that that's a terrific question, and the answer is no. And the answer is it's disgusting the extent to which we see politicians. I think presidents basically ever since Reagan have been doing this. They're giving a speech to the troops where they line up the troops behind the president, sort of using them as a backdrop.
And mission accomplished.
I think that's a mission accomplished. I think that is wrong, but. I'm sorry to say that's really become part of politics.
But, Andrew, again, just a little bit to go before a break, and we're going to keep going on this. But doesn't that add to a troop's sense that they need to have a say? If they're being used as a backdrop, doesn't that add to their sense that they need to have a say and to things like the petition for redress?
I'm critical of the petition for redress. But I absolutely acknowledge the extent to which the forces that are promoting the politicization of the military don't just come from the military, that it really is a reflection of the political environment that's existed for the last quarter of a century. Plenty of blame to go around.
Andrew Bacevich, retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, professor of international relations at Boston University. When we come back, well, we'll continue with the blame, the role of the generals, as we said, the role of the media, and the changed ethos in the military having to do with the fact that we don't have a draft anymore. We'll get his opinion on that. That's after the break. Again, if you have a question or want to weigh in, letters@here-now.com. You're listening to Here Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with Andrew Bacevich, professor of international relations at Boston University. By the way, his most recent book is The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. We're talking about the anti- and pro-war movement within the U.S. military, what he's called the new soldiers' lobby. And it's most seen in two online petitions, one for courage, one asking Congress to stick with the war, another a petition for redress, soldiers asking for U.S. withdrawal. And Andrew Bacevich, you note that this is more than just a war you've been very critical of. It's about a change in ethos of the military. What do you mean?
Well, I think one of the interesting and underappreciated changes in the American military in the last 30 years, related to the creation of the all-volunteer force, the end of the draft, mm-hmm. is that the status of young enlisted soldiers is not what it used to be. In the old days of the draft army, an enlisted soldier was basically a blue-collar employee.
It could be anybody, too.
Could have been anybody.
Yeah.
In the all-volunteer force, the junior enlisted soldier is viewed almost from the outset as a professional. somebody whose time is valued, somebody who is now carefully trained, somebody who the institution hopes will stay in for the long haul. And all that is very positive in many respects. But I think that has caused young soldiers who see themselves as emerging professionals, as people who then say, well, then why shouldn't I have a say?
Right.
Why shouldn't I have a say in the way this institution is run and the sorts of things we do?
Right. And it's also 30 years after Vietnam. It's a time when everybody has a say, whether it's talk shows or talk radio or your own blogs. There's an atmosphere of opinion.
I think that's a fair point. I mean, in the traditional ethos of a soldier, really part of that ethos is one of silent, self-effacing service, and being silent and self-effacing really is not part of American culture today. So that, too, probably contributes to this.
What's so interesting is you also write that many who don't serve now proclaim their high regard for people who do, in part because those who aren't serving feel guilty. So there's a completely different attitude towards troops than there was during Vietnam, and troops know that.
And the civilians who proclaim their admiration for the soldiers. I just got an email in my office from somebody who is chewing me out for being too cynical about this. I don't mean to be cynical about it, but it does seem to me that to the extent that we put soldiers on some kind of a pedestal and begin to see them as morally superior, then we lose sight of what ought to be our concern as citizens, which is that we should be engaged with the politicians in the political process in shaping military policy, and we should be wary of the extent to which soldiers themselves are entering into the political arena.
It's interesting because there's a certain irony here, too, because during the draft, the troops, did not make a choice. As you write, today they have made the choice, which some would say would be all the more reason, nobody forced you to join the military, all the more reason for them to abide by the pledge they took to obey. Mm-hmm. But then, I've got an email here from Bill Wilt out on Long Island. He says, how can you demand that a soldier analyze all his orders and disobey illegal orders, let's say Nuremberg, Abu Ghraib, but not speak out when they think another order to go to war in and of itself is wrong?
Well, we have to think our way through that proposition. Do we want to have a military in which everybody has to think about and analyze and assess and approve every order coming down from the chain of command? That's a recipe not for an effective army. That's a recipe for a rabble, for a mob. So the principle of obedience, with the exception of orders that are clearly illegal, seems to me something that, again, citizens in a democracy ought to support.
In your essay, again, in The Atlantic and online at here-now.org, we'll have it for you, you also criticized the so-called General's Revolt. This was last year when several retired senior officers blasted then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, called on him to resign over his handling of the war in Iraq. You call this beyond the pale.
Well, right? As much as I am concerned about the appeal for redress as indicative of an emerging soldiers' lobby, a far larger problem has to do with the politicization of the officer corps and the willingness of senior officers to engage in politics. Again, the issue is not whether or not I approve of or oppose a particular policy, whether these guys are saying what I think or whether they're not. The principle is one in which we need to be very, very cautious about erosions of civilian control. And in my judgment, the so-called General's Revolt of last year, where officers who were in the process of moving towards retirement spoke out against senior civilian authority, I thought was unprofessional and wrong. And I think it was deeply unfortunate that the media did not call the generals on this, but basically gave them a platform to speak.
Andrew Bacevich, we have a little over a minute, but I just want to remind people you are a retired officer. You have a son in Iraq, and you prefer to leave him out of the discussion. But given those two things in your background, I'm just wondering if another problem that you worry about with soldiers increasingly debating the war in Iraq is, how they might turn on each other. That it can't be good for unity.
Well, I had not heard about the appeal for courage until today, as a response to the appeal for redress. But I think that points up that danger. Do we want to have an army that's divided into competitive camps where one side argues in favor of a policy and the other side argues against it? That's not good for the military. It's not good for the country.
Andrew Bacevich, again, professor of international relations at Boston University. His most recent book is The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. He's also retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. He served in Vietnam. And as we said, professor of international relations at Boston University. His essay about the appeal for redress and the new citizens' lobby, as he calls it, appears in the May issue of the Atlantic Monthly, and it's on our website, here-now.org. Andrew, as always, it's good to see you.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us more after a break, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Presidential hopeful Senator John McCain faces a crucial week ahead. He'll be giving a policy statement on Iraq, for one thing, after a disastrous trip to that country last week, where after a tour of a local market, he had this exchange with a reporter at a press conference.
Senator McCain, I just read in the internet that you said there are areas in Baghdad that you can walk around freely.
Yeah, I just came from one.
Pardon me?
I just came from one.
Well, last night on 60 Minutes, McCain admitted that he misspoke in part in his characterization of that trip, which 60 Minutes cameras showed was heavily protected with two Apache attack helicopters circulating overhead, not your average shopping spree. But McCain also said he still feels that aspects of the current surge in troops in Iraq are working. Well, John Harwood joins us now. He's chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and columnist for The Wall Street Journal. And John, do you think we're seeing this once Republican front runner unraveling in this campaign?
I don't know if he's unraveling, Robin, but he's certainly facing a much, much difficult, more difficult time than anybody expected, not just in terms of his message and Iran getting in the way of his attempt to sort of light the fire again with Republican voters, but also in terms of the campaign money. We've seen him badly trailing Mitt Romney, who's a newcomer to the race, somebody who the McCain campaign once thought they would dispatch rather easily, and also Rudy Giuliani. So he's going to have to do a lot better in the second quarter than he did in the first quarter if he's going to get that maverick thing going again.
Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani pulled in $21 million and $15 million, respectively, to McCain's $12.5 million. Mitt Romney has his own problems. He said last week that he was a lifelong hunter. It turns out he's only been hunting twice. But he did bring in the money, as you said. Why hasn't McCain done that?
You know, it's a mystery. And I actually thought he was going to do much better in the money chase. He and his team, which ran very competitively against George W. Bush in 2000, came pretty close to denying Bush the nomination, have been planning this for a long time. He's got smart political people around him, John Weaver, Rick Davis, and others. Terry Nelson's his campaign manager. They've been building what they thought was going to be a sort of front runner's fort. And that's typically been rewarded in the Republican Party. Frontrunners do very well among Republicans. But really what we're seeing is a little bit of payback from conservatives who never trusted McCain when he was challenging Bush in 2000, and the surprising resonance that Rudy Giuliani has found, even though he's for abortion rights and other things that ought to make him, by traditional calculations, anathema to the Republican base. And Mitt Romney, who, as that hunting episode indicates, has got some flip-flop problems and some issues in terms of changing his stances to suit voters. McCain's got to overcome some of those surprising charges by those two candidates, perhaps others. Fred Thompson, who wants to get in the race.
Well, you know, and we should add that his followers, his supporters, McCain's supporters, might say, well, wait a second, he's the only one of those top three who actually has to work right now. He's got to work on the war in Iraq as opposed to just campaigning.
Not only is he the only one who has to work, Robin, he's the only one who has a consistent pro-life record within the Republican Party. That's supposed to count for something. We've become accustomed to thinking that only solid pro-life candidates can do well in the Republican Party. Rudy Giuliani is testing that bit of conventional wisdom right now, in part because he's got the 9/11 halo from his performance after those attacks that seems to be suspending the normal laws of political gravity and allowing him to appeal on security issues, which we thought were McCain's strength.
Right. Let's talk about that. In the 60 Minutes interview, McCain was asked why he blames Donald Rumsfeld for mishandling the war, but seems to give President Bush a pass. McCain said, no, the president is ultimately responsible. But he doesn't seem critical of the president. And also, it seems particularly awkward, given, as you refer to, the 2000 presidential race, when the Bush campaign was suspected of starting that whisper campaign against McCain, negative images. And 60 Minutes contrasted, you know, questions about that of McCain. Why are you so supportive with images of McCain now embracing Bush? And it did seem, I don't know how else to put it, it seemed to diminish John McCain somewhat.
Well, the effect of everything that's happened over the last few months has seemed in the public's eyes to diminish John McCain. Look, it's no mystery why he's standing with George W. Bush right now. Even though the Iraq War is broadly unpopular with the American people, President Bush remains having the support of roughly 70% of the Republican base. So John McCain cannot easily go and slap George Bush around and hope to do well with Republican primary voters. Don Rumsfeld's another thing. He's already been fired by Bush. And to McCain's credit, he has been consistent on that point. He was criticizing McCain for a couple of years before, I'm sorry, was criticizing right. Rumsfeld for a couple of years before Rumsfeld was fired. But it's not easy to go win the Republican nomination by hitting an incumbent Republican president. He's not going to do that.
Right. Quick question. Mark Fisher writes in his Washington Post blog that the man McCain has hired as his new national finance co-chair is Fred Malik, who worked in the Nixon White House and at one time came up with a list of Jewish employees in the Bureau of Labor Statistics for Nixon, some of whom were demoted as a result of that list. Do you think McCain's going to have another little brush fire to put out?
A small one, I think. That story has followed Fred Malik for a long time. He served in a prominent role in the reelection campaign of the first President Bush in 1992 and managed to get beyond that particular episode. I think that's a lesser problem than the fact that McCain is reaching back to a previous generation of Republican leaders like Fred Malik and trying to resuscitate his campaign. He needs to make his campaign relevant to younger Republicans now. Mitt Romney is eating his lunch on that score.
Well, John, speaking of brush fires, and in the minute or so we have, this actually is a conflagration. We're wondering how Washington is reacting to Don Imus's comments. He made racist remarks on the air about the Rutgers women's basketball team, remarks about their hair, also unbelievably referred to them as, if you will, women of the night. He's apologized. He said he'll go on Al Sharpton's radio show, but Sharpton said he accepts the apology, but he wants Imus's bosses to accept his resignation. How's Washington reacting? Because all of Washington seems at different times to be on his show.
Well, that's exactly the issue. Not only is a lot of official Washington on his show, but Don Imus gets good ratings. And we've seen in the media business that that is a very, very important dimension. The remarks were shocking, and it's been a little bit surprising that there hasn't been more of a blowback. But we did see Don Imus out this morning repeating his apology, and he's not going to give up that job easily, and I think he's going to do a lot more apologizing before this is done.
Well, and we should say you've only been on the show maybe once, and Imus wasn't there, but you know, why do people go on? Why even today, after the big hoopla, several power brokers, I can't remember who, they were on the show. Why do they do it?
I think there are a couple of reasons. One, some of them think it's funny. Two, it gives them an outlet with a pretty good set of ratings numbers, so they reach a lot of people. And three, I think to some of them, because it's has a humorous aspect to it, they think it makes them seem a little bit hip with people, and that's an asset with younger viewers, younger voters.
We'll see how that plays out. John Harwood, as we said, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC, columnist for The Wall Street Journal, and only once a guest on the Don Imus Show. John, thanks so much for weighing in.
My pleasure.
Okay, before we go today, author Rebecca Walker on ambivalence, motherhood, and her own mother, Alice Walker. You're listening to Here and Now. Tis the season. Major League Baseball teams are getting reacquainted with fans, and at least one case here in Boston meeting them for the first time. Tomorrow is opening day at Fenway Park, home of the Red Sox, and now Japanese phenom Daisuke Matsuzaka and his gyro ball. Japanese fans have been flocking to the park where their hero will pitch Wednesday. We send here now intern Emily Reddy to Fenway, where Daisuke Mania is in full swing.
Okay, all our 3 o'clock tour people, everybody here, nice to see everyone. My name is Ed, and I'm your tour guide. How are you?
Ed Carpenter is giving his last tour of the day. There are families from New York, the Midwest, and then from Fukuoka, Japan, there's Jun Ueda.
I just wanted to see the atmosphere of this ballpark. You know, I just want to feel it.
Daisuke is the only reason Ueda made the 7,000-mile trip to Boston. He says that Matsuzaka is playing for all of Japan.
Well, he's really excited about him. Watching him on TV, we think it's a really good thing Japanese baseball players can beat world-famous players.
Ed Carpenter has seen droves of Japanese fans since it was announced that Daisuke would join the team.
I had a group of Japanese schoolgirls. They spoke very, very little English, but they wanted to come over to see where Daisuke was going to pitch.
Are teenage girls in Japan bigger baseball fans than their American counterparts? Well, maybe. Or maybe it's the celebrity status Daisuke and his wife, Tomoyo Shibata, command in Japan. Carpenter says they are the Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie of Japan.
Wherever they go, there are cameras following them. Wherever they go, there are newspaper people following them. And I think that probably prepares them for what they're in store for here in Boston, that they're used to being adulated, and that's what they will be here in Boston.
I would say between 30 to 50% of the people that walk in the door are of Asian descent.
Maggie Bartlett sees Daisuke Mania firsthand. She's the marketing manager at the Red Sox store across the street from the ballpark. And since Daisuke joined the team, she says business has been booming.
I think that the minute they signed him, they gained an entire new fan base.
And Bartlett's store is ready with a whole line of Daisuke t-shirts, jerseys, and caps. There's even a new team shirt that sports a Japanese flag with Red Sox written in Japanese characters. Bartlett says sales of Daisuke merchandise have been phenomenal.
In 2006, he was one of my top 10 sellers, and I only sold him for 2 weeks. So he beat out, solid players that had been here all year.
Bartlett says she's had to order a lot more smalls and mediums to fit her new customers and hire a Japanese translator. Ihei came in to buy T-shirts for her sister in Tokyo. She joked that the store was going to need a Japanese salesperson. And before you know it,
manager came. She wanted to interview me, you know. So, and then that place, you know, she gave me this job, so.
Did they put you to work that day?
No, 2-3 days later.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So it was just luck.
Luck.
Hay says Japanese fans don't just come in and buy a couple of T-shirts. They buy 20 or 30. She says it's a Japanese custom.
For example, Japanese have to buy lots of souvenirs when they're going to travel. Even 1 day or 2 day trip, they have to buy something to the neighbors or co-workers. Without souvenir, they cannot go back to, you know, office.
How many people are taking their first trip to Fenway Park? First trip. Yeah. Welcome.
Back across the street, Fenway Park is seeing changes too. The press box has been expanded to fit up to 75 Japanese media expected at every game. Red Sox management now carry business cards printed in Japanese, and a section of prized green monster seats is being sold as a package deal geared for Japanese fans, complete with translator. Daisuke Mania has even spread beyond Fenway Park. After the game, fans can enjoy a new drink at Boston's Ritz-Carlton. It's called the Daisuke Teeny, a martini made with vodka, passion fruit puree, and of course, sake.
Let's hear now is Emily Reddy. Daisuke Matsuzaka pitches his first game in Fenway Wednesday night against the Seattle Mariners. Stay with us, more ahead here and now.
A
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. You know those stories about generations of women helping the youngest in the family to have and raise a baby? You know, that whole takes a village thing? Or a mother and daughter who heal an estranged relationship through the birth of a beloved new grandchild. Well, this is not one of those stories. This is the story of a daughter fiercely choosing to be a mother despite the lack of evidence that her own mother enjoyed that role very much, or that as a member of the first real post-Roe v. Wade generation, the daughter spent most of her time and energy trying not to have a baby. Rebecca Walker's new book is Baby Love, Choosing Motherhood After a Lifetime of Ambivalence, an ambivalence she might have inherited from her mother, author Alice Walker.
In a poem, she compares me to various calamities that struck and impeded the lives of other women writers. Virginia Woolf was mentally ill, and the Brontes died prematurely. My mother has me, whom she lists as a delightful distraction, but by context and comparison, it's clear I was a calamity just the same. The effect of living with my mother's ambivalence about the role of children in a woman's life, the role of me in her life, could not bode well for me having my own.
And Rebecca Walker joins us now from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I just mentioned your mom, and I know a lot of heads have shot up because of that. Your mom, Alice Walker. How did your sense of your mother's sense of, you know, birthing you lend to your early feelings about getting pregnant?
Well, I think, you know, my mom was a part of the very important second wave of feminism. That whole generation of thinking critical women launched a very important critique of motherhood, because motherhood had historically been used as a way to justify women staying home and being domesticated. But part of the problem with launching that critique is that then many of them who ended up having children may have felt some ambivalence about, you know, whether or not some of their creativity or their professional aspirations or even their just fundamental energy would be sapped by a child.
You write, you instinctively felt you had to be loyal to your mom. To stop working and to have kids around your neck like anvils would smell of betrayal and a lack of appreciation for the progress made on behalf of women's liberation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. People don't talk about these kinds of things.
Yeah, I know, but we must, you know, because all of these various movements, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the queer movement, they are often theoretically and intellectually sound and important, but at the same time, there are personal after effects, you know, that we need to be honest about.
Well, and you do note that not all feminists felt this way. You had a stepmother who was very warm towards you. And you write about another element that you say added to this disconnect you felt with your birth mom. She was famous, you say narcissistic. But I'm thinking a lot of women will read that and say, I had this same disconnect, but my mother was alcoholic or traumatized. You know, I'm just wondering if the common thing you all share is that your ambivalence about motherhood might have been fear, you know, at being a mother when you felt you didn't have one to back you up.
Absolutely.
Tell me about that.
Well, I think, you know, it's something that every mom-to-be and person longing to be a mom goes through. You can't prepare, and the anxiety is tremendous.
Yeah. But you leap. You embark. Tell us some of the things that as you were realizing how much you very much wanted to have a baby, some of the preconceptions you had, no pun intended, and some of the discoveries you made.
It was the best decision of my life. I think because it forced me to become very protective of this unborn child. And in becoming more protective of him, I became more protective of myself. And I stopped allowing certain kinds of negative behaviors and interactions to be a part of my life and saying no to unhealthy relationships.
Well, and we keep coming back to it, but one of them was the relationship with your mom. There's a flurry of emails in which you say you tell her that you need apologies from her for her ambivalence towards you. She writes back, she's tired of apologizing, and what?
She at one point wrote me an email that said that she had been my mother for 30 odd years and that she was frankly, you know, tired of the job. And she signed her name instead of mom at the end of the email. And I was devastated. And, you know, it was during the time of the Michael Jackson trial and the Scott Peterson trial. And I kept looking at the mothers, you know, here Michael Jackson's been accused of abusing untold number of boys, and Scott Peterson has just chopped up his wife, and both of their mothers are just standing by their sides and saying, you know, my kid is wonderful, that he never could have done, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, God, what have I done to have a mom who would say that to me? I mean, I fully expect my son to have issues with me at some point, and I hope to be able to understand and love him unconditionally through whatever may come up, you know, because I know that I've done my best.
Well, and after you have this baby, after a difficult pregnancy, and he's very ill in the beginning, and it's kind of heart-stopping, but he's fine. He comes home with you. But after the experience, you write, you instantly retract your judgment of every woman who's ever had an epidural, which you immediately demanded. You pronounced your newfound respect for every woman who'd ever given birth. And in reading that, because you do go through some huge changes, at one point you thought you were going to have a home birth with some sort of polytheistic fiesta.
Yeah. You know, I thought I was going to be in the hot tub. Everyone was going to be rubbing my scalp with lavender essential oil and feeding me organic chocolate cake. And then, of course, that first contraction hit, or the 10th or the 100th, and I just basically started screaming for the epidural.
Right.
And was so glad I was in the hospital and not at home. You know, but obviously not every woman, you know, needs to have an epidural or be in a hospital, and I totally support that.
Right. And, you know, I guess at that point you're becoming, you know, a fuller person, as anyone would. You've gone through this experience, letting go of some of your preconceived notions and your judgments, as you write. And it made me wonder, gee, do you think there's ever going to be a time that you might, and maybe you already have, forgive your mom?
In many ways, I have forgiven my mom. At this point, it's just a matter of whether or not we can have a healthy relationship. I'm not really so into the idea of forgiveness and then continuing to do the same injurious actions.
And what would you say to other youngish women who maybe are, you know, relating to this idea of ambivalence, or maybe not even knowing yet that they have ambivalence, that they think they have a certain opinion about having a child? What would you want them to know?
I'm trying to bring the message that I wish I had gotten when I was in my early to mid-20s, which is that it's a wonderful experience to become a mom, that it doesn't necessarily have to conflict with your sense of independence and creativity and potential. Just be aware that ambivalence itself can be immobilizing, that life is very short, ultimately, and the more you can move toward decisiveness, the clearer you will be.
And that part of that, it sounds like, is staring honestly in the face a relationship like a relationship with a mother, that in fact there might be something else underlying your decision making that you got to root out and deal with.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. Part of preparing for a child is assessing the familial relationships and trying to discern what aspects are healthy that you want to pass on and what aspects are not. And I think staring straight at it and trying to really come to terms is key.
Rebecca Walker's book is Baby Love: Choosing Motherhood After a Lifetime of Ambivalence. Rebecca, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And by the way, to date, Alice Walker has not commented publicly on her daughter's book. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.